Confusion matrix.
Just stopping, thinking, what are we doing here? And then experimenting with simplifying the process. And, you know, what's the first agile value is individuals and interactions over processes and tools, getting individuals to interact with one another rather than focusing on a process. The heart of the matter, the focus of the experiment was getting individuals to interact with one another. Now, to your point, yes, we can bring AI or an agent into that, which maybe speeds up that process even more. I said it took a couple of weeks to focus on one thing. Maybe we could use AI to more rapidly prototype, more rapidly learn. The thing about AI is it's an amplifier, right? If they had added AI to that massive, complicated process, I think it would have made things worse. It would have made those invisible cues even longer. But if they add it to a good, simple process, then yeah, it might make things better. So if you've got a rubbish process, I think AI might make it even worse. If you've got a good one, it'll make it even better.
And we are rolling. Welcome back, Pete. How are you today?
I'm very well. Reasonably nice sunny morning. How are you?
I just feel like I've got so much on at the moment and I can't decide whether I'm enjoying it or I want to go and hide in the corner and weep to myself. But good. We've got our special guest early there, Pete. Is that your dog?
Yeah, absolutely.
Good, perfect timing as always. Anyway, well, on the subject of special guests, we have an actual human special guest. Although Pete, you're welcome to bring your dog. What's your dog's name? I forget.
Nala.
Nala. There you go. Nala, who is a little ball of whitish fluff, right?
Yeah, very lion-esque.
Yes, I can imagine. The small ones are always the scariest. We are joined today by Toby Dyke. Say hello, Toby.
Hello. Hi, everyone.
So just a quick background on why Toby's here. Me and Toby go a long way back, which we'll discuss in due course. We released an episode of a few weeks ago, I think, called The Slowly Shrinking SDLC, which was our view on the progression of the software development life cycle to a more compact form with the help of AI and AI agents. Toby pops up on my LinkedIn and wrote several paragraphs of interesting analysis, to which my response was, rather than actually responding in text, as a normal person would do, I said, do you want to come on my podcast? So with precisely zero extra preparation than that, Toby graciously agreed to turn up and explain himself for the masses. So we'll get into that. But Toby, do you want to give us a quick intro?
Yeah, sure. I love the fact I'm introduced after the dog. But
know your place, Toby. Know your place.
Exactly that. So a bit of background on me. So I'm Toby Dykes. Yeah, I'm based in the UK. I've got a background kind of in like what we call delivery, so project program management, over the last 25 years or so. But where I've worked with you, Alex, before, in a couple of places, it's been mainly about kind of innovation, but that's less around kind of hoverboards and 4D printers and more around the kind of culture and process to enable rapid learning. Work as an agile coach, trying to help teams, I suppose in a similar way, not how to, and we'll probably talk about it later, but how to indoctrinate people into using Scrum, but to actually understand the kind of values and principles of Agile and some of the associated practices. And I think the thing I like about what I do is it's kind of applicable across all industries, as far as I can tell and as far as I've found so far. So I've worked across, I don't know, pharma, construction, retail, public sector, education, kind of everything really, a lot of travel actually, and that's me.
And so you're in a sizable consultancy right now. Would that be a reasonable...
Yeah, I work as a consultant these days. Yeah, that's right.
And just in terms of you two who have never met before 10 minutes ago, the two obvious points of bonding here is a background in project program management and Scrum. I'll let you elaborate, Pete. And also an interest in the fine arts of football, which... Uh-huh. Both of you will have experienced my general demeanor on that particular sport, so I'll not elaborate on that. Needless to say, I'm not particularly looking forward to the World Cup, but I'm sure there's some team-based chest beating to be done between the two of you. What are the teams?
Well, you know, dare I say it, being in London, an Arsenal fan, and you know, looking forward to the next week. And hopefully topping the Premier League. But I noticed, Toby, you had a Bristol Rovers mug there or something.
Yeah, very similar levels of success, actually, Pete. So yeah, Bristol Rovers finished a spectacular 14th this season. So that's good.
There you go. Always fascinating. And at some point, Pete has promised to do an episode on his football stats and analysis and stuff. Maybe we'll have you back on again for that, Toby. But I fear we can get heavily sidetracked into that, and I'd rather not. Okay, so introduction's over. Do you want? I mean, this, when I look at your very interesting and erudite response to our episode, there's quite a lot going on here. So rather than me trying to break that down, do you want to give us a quick thousand foot view of why you felt the need to respond and what you said?
Yeah, so I think I broadly agreed with you. The main kind of point, the main point of view I've got on this is that throughout the kind of software engineering industry, we have this metaphor of a production line, and that's just assumed to be the way things are done. And sometimes that's appropriate, but quite often it isn't. All right. So why do production lines exist? Okay. So maybe in a car plant or something, that exists to repetitively kind of create something or things which get put together. So this is where we kind of know what the output or the solution needs to be. So if that's the kind of underlying mental model or assumption, then your behavior will assume that more is better. So the more we do of this thing, the better. So if you're creating cars, then, I mean, we could get into kind of just-in-time manufacturing, but let's assume that the cars are going to sell, all right? The 1,000th Yaris that comes off the production line is going to be as in demand as the 999th, okay? But software is not usually like that. Sometimes it is, but often we don't know, nor can we know what the solution should be, right? So we know what we want to achieve. You know, that might be increased sales, reduced costs, I don't know, more people using or engaging, engagement with the product. In a complex domain, we can't know what the solution needs to be. And it will also need to change. So what we actually need is to enable emergence so that the thing can emerge as we learn more about it, but it doesn't just like reveal itself to us. We need to deliver the software in a way that allows us to learn as rapidly as possible what it should be. So we don't do that by just churning out stuff. We do it with a kind of, you know, with an assumed success. We do it with kind of humility and experimentation and crucially short feedback loops. So where we deliver a thing and then assess whether it is what's wanted, what's needed, what works, and then we either build on it, double down on it, or we do something else. But there's a problem there, yeah, which is that as kind of leaders, we struggle with this kind of humility. As leaders, we're expected to know what the answer or solution would be. So we end up with this kind of mental model of we just need to deliver a thing. We know what success looks like. We know what it has to be. And that results in these kind of counterintuitive or counterproductive, rather, even detrimental behaviors of increased velocity, more people, better estimates, just churn through faster and faster and faster. So that's the kind of crux of it. I can go on a bit more about even when
when, if we are going to use this production line kind of analogy or metaphor, why even, if it is appropriate, we even do the wrong thing there. But that's just my initial kind of thinking on it and what I tried to convey to you, Alex.
Yeah, and I agree, I think, wholeheartedly. Me and Pete have used the production line analogy quite a lot in certain circumstances. It sort of helps. But I think most of the time we're using the production line analogy to show why the world isn't really like that, and or any given project isn't really like that. And I think honestly, the way you've described, it was really a really great description. The way you've described that is sort of exactly how we work and what we do. So it won't surprise you to know we sort of agree. I was saying we, Pete can have his own opinion, but like, it's sort of what we do. And this idea that, yeah, it's been hard in the past to prove the value or the how something's going to work or look or feel. And so you sort of just had to build it and hope for the best. And obviously you allude to the fact that certain leaders sort of feel their opinion is extremely salient and important. But you often ended up getting through a whole sort of waterfall cycle or even agile cycle and deliver something that really isn't fit for purpose. And there's absolutely no reason to do that anymore. So I sort of understand why we were that way 20 years ago, maybe even 10 years ago. But now you can iterate really quickly and prove concepts at different scales with relatively little actual effort. I guess the obvious counter that always jumps out at me here is that obviously then you risk a new flavor of chaos where, you know, you're trying everything all the time and you burn a lot of energy being experimental. But yes, I'm broadly in favour. Pete?
Yeah, well, I think what's really interesting here is the sort of, what I think of as the temporal or time aspect, because the bigger the thing you want to build, or not necessarily big, but depending on the tools and how long it takes, the sort of investment in being able to produce it. So if you go back, 30 years, producing software was, quite hard from beginning to end result. There'd be lots of steps and lots of people involved because you've got different machines and, there was less iterativeness, and then bring in sort of IDEs and web interfaces, and all of a sudden you can be sitting with a business person and be talking to them and actually convert that into something, you can call it wire mock-ups. And now with the next step of AI, you can actually be knocking out working systems, albeit maybe slightly noddy. But you can make that happen much, much quicker. And the reason why I think that matters here is because if it's going to take you 3 weeks and three people, that then you've got a new thing that comes in here, which is you've got three people you need to coordinate and you need to sort of make sure they're all doing the right bit at the right time, and then it all plugs together at the end. And in order to do that, you start writing things down, you start having meetings, you start to produce peripheral artifacts, if you like, in order to coordinate that. And then what is interesting about the IT kind of world and the software development world is, because you now have those artifacts, well, they're now something you can examine and you can look for improvements and look for efficiency. And then we start to really lean into the manufacturing ethos, where you kind of look at it and you go, oh, look, we've got a process here. Look, I can write that process down. Oh, now we can look for improvements. All right. Now all of a sudden, everyone's focused on the efficiency of that pipeline. But as you say, Toby, actually sort of forgetting that pipeline was just something that worked for the thing you're doing now and seems to have some sort of template or similar feel to the next bit of work, but actually isn't exactly the same. And so one of the things experienced in one of the consultancies we worked in with people who are non-technically focused was they were delivering projects, but didn't focus on the process of delivery at all. And so what was interesting there is there was no push to improve their sausage factory because they didn't really know what the process of their sausage factory looked like. They didn't know what their production line was like because they didn't spend a lot of time navel gazing and, you know, writing out the process and looking to template that across the company. And that was really interesting to me because it felt like there were a lot of easy pickings there, but at the same time, realizing that I was already, you know, by talking about getting a process down for how they deliver work, already you find your thinking is starting to go into the, you know, the manufacturing, which isn't necessarily the right way, but it felt better than just haphazardly doing things and never seeing any familiarity at all. So I don't know what you think of that, Toby, in terms of, you know, the longer something takes, the more steps and process you introduce.
Yeah, it's quite a lot there. And yeah. I think that the thing that you said at the start around if you're creating a big thing, well, you know, initially we're assuming it has to be a big thing. It has to be a big complex thing. And I think that's quite an assumption to make early on. Also, Alex, you said that's not how the world works in terms of this kind of production line, but it is how many, many organizations adopt this almost unthinkingly, like there's no other solution. And then maybe coming back to your point, Pete, the way people try to optimize, once they have got this kind of production line, the way they try to optimize it is without any understanding of how production lines work. So that, you know, there's no understanding of kind of queuing theory, theory of constraints, Little's law, all this kind of stuff. So the assumption is that what we need to do is make the sausage machine work faster, or worse than that, push more sausage meat into it. Right. And then you end up with, stuff taking too long, stretching the analogy further, stuff taking too long to get through that sausage machine. So you have all kind of wait states and queues and so forth, and you end up with moldy sausages. There's a real lack of understanding of this kind of production lines and queuing theory. So we kind of double down on the mess we've created, and we've really focused on busyness and more people and so forth. I suppose the thing, bringing it back to you mentioned in the podcast I was listening to about kind of Jira, what we end up with is queues to get to the next phase, and then queues after that phase and more queues. Now, if you were on an actual physical production line, you'd be literally tripping over the inventory, okay? But something like Jira conveniently hides that away from us. We don't see these queues, and even if we do, they're not inconvenient to us in that moment because it's just data, it's just there. But what we don't see is we can't see the overall system and the time it takes for a single thing to get through this entire system, which brings me back to that concept about feedback loops. You end up with these massively long feedback loops in weeks, measured in weeks or maybe even months, where an idea only comes to fruition months later. And then we've kind of forgotten why we came up with the idea. We're not interested in validating it. But, you know, it's no longer an experiment. It's just a thing that has to be done. So it's kind of layers of confusion, I suppose.
So my mind is literally exploding with opinions on this. But before we do that, you name check the theory of constraints and Little's law several times in there, and I actually don't know what either mean, and I really don't. So can you explain to me like a 5-year-old, please?
Right. So let's go with theory of constraints. So theory of constraints essentially is that any system will always have a constraint. Right, one thing that's kind of preventing flow, which is what we're trying to enable. And there is no point spending any effort in optimizing anything other than the constraint. Okay,
a constraint, do you mean like if you're trying to put water through the pipe, then the width of the pipe is the problem?
If someone stood on the pipe, that's the constraint.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
If somebody's stood on the pipe a little bit less, further up or further down, there's no point focusing on that. You need to focus on the constraint, all right, which is where someone stood. So if you focus your effort on anything upstream of the constraint,
what you end up doing is creating bigger queues in front of the constraint. And queues are bad things because of that lengthy lead time. If you focus your time on anything below the constraint, then that's kind of wasted effort, yeah, because you're not enabling flow through the entire system. So what we end up doing is focusing on the wrong areas, and we create what are called local optimizations. It's kind of, it at best makes no difference to the overall lead time through the entire system, but at worst, it can make the situation worse than it was previously because you are lengthening those lead times by creating queues, by creating, I don't know if water is a good metaphor, but like in a cartoon, you've got that pipe kind of getting bigger and bigger in front of the constraint.
Since the two absent-minded professors here forgot to define Little's Law, allow me to do so on their behalf. Little's Law says the number of things stuck in your system equals how fast stuff arrives multiplied by how long each thing hangs around. If customers show up at 10 per hour and each spends half an hour in your shop, you'll have 5 people in there on average. Simple as that. Works for anything. Hospital waiting rooms, computer processes, traffic jams. Checkout queues. More arrivals or longer waits means more congestion. Want fewer things clogging your system? Speed up processing or slow down intake.
How do you know where that constraint is, given that, if we're developing little small point solutions, you know, bits of software for one use and stuff, I guess it should be quite obvious, but that's not really what we're talking about here. You might be talking about a fairly big project or even a whole program of multiple projects and stuff. So how do we know what the constraints are?
What we've immediately done here, like, is assumed that we're going to work with the production line, right? So there's ways for doing that, but immediately we've kind of gone into, and this is no real criticism of you, Alex, but it's kind of what happens, which is, hey, we're going to assume that production's line is the thing, so we need to find the constraint, yada, 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 right? Rather than go into that, I think what's important to do is to think that if we've got a system, it's important to recognize it as a system and look at it and conceive of it as a system rather than thinking of the individual elements. Okay, so yeah, you could do that by measuring the cycle times through each individual section, etc., etc. But rather than that, it's just this notion of actually recognizing we've got a system here with interconnected parts and we need to think of it or conceive of it systematically.
Yes. I tell you what, why I pause there, because I can't, my head's swimming. Pete, bail me out here. I there's so much here. The problem is, like, well, I'll tell you what, this is quite a nice analogy, is that so much stuff has just been said that it's all backed up in a big pipe in my brain.
Yes.
Behind the constraint of my narrow cognition. So someone's going to have to bail me out here.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I think it's a really good point in terms of how people think about things. I was thinking of some project management work I was doing a few years ago. And what was interesting, what was highlighted was, it was a company that was moving to Agile. And they kind of did it in quite a, for me, a sort of slightly extreme way. So what happened was the IT guys went, all right, well, we're doing Agile and Scrum now. They got a Scrum coach in. And so they suddenly spoke about everything in terms of Agile. And it was kind of 10 being the swear jar if you said anything outside of that. And one of the consequences of that was, well, we're not going to give you plans. That's not how we work. You tell us the thing you want, the business sort of story that you problem that you want solving, and then we'll work with you and we'll break that down, and we're not going to give any promises on delivery because as you sort of rightly say, Toby, we don't really know what that end game looks like at this point, and that created a massive amount of friction straight away.
Yeah.
Because business people were going, what? And what was really funny was that the analogy that people jumped to almost straight away was, well, this is like getting builders around my house. And if I ask them to, do an extension, I don't expect them to say, oh, I'm going to start next week and I'll finish when I finish. I want a quote. I want to know roughly when it is. And it was really interesting that people couldn't get out of their heads that, well, look, this is a complex system. We're not going to know what the end game looks like, and just kept coming back to, yeah, but in the real world, I need to know what it looks like. And it was exactly as you say, Toby, it was the forcing of some form of real world analogy, which brings its own set of common way that things are built, ways that they're done. I know what builders do. I've seen them work. You must give me something that's similar to that. And whether it's building or manufacturing or whatever, you know, ultimately, and I'm sure you know this as a project manager, that's now on you after those initial meetings. Or can you go and produce me a plan, please? And I want to see that plan sort of itemized, as in you didn't just pick a number out of the air. But, you know, yeah, I want to see those things build up.
But Pete, right, so I can see the kind of business side of this as well. Like you need dates, you need to know when some stuff's going to be delivered, all right? So, and it slightly irks me when people say we can't be agile or do agile, whatever that might mean, because we have hard deadlines, right? Because I think hard deadlines are actually a really good thing. Mm-hmm. But the thing that you need to be able to flex is the fidelity of the solution, right? Which is the word that isn't used very often, but it kind of works for me. Okay.
Yeah.
So imagine a scenario where so Alex wants to get a new job, right? So that we need to kind of advertise, promote Alex's amazing skills and experience, right? So what we could do is, if we had a year to do this, the deadline's a year, right? Alex has got a year's gardening leave, right? We've got a year to do this. We could say, right, we're going to build the world's best website, okay? We're going to have a CRM so we can manage all the relationships. We're going to have a content management system. We're going to go out to tender to see who wants to provide the content management system. We're going to get this professional photographer in to do these amazing photos of Alex. We're going to get a content writer to come in and write this brilliant stuff, right? We're going to have a project plan that shows that it's brilliant. That will take a year. If we had 2 months, right? Your notice period is 2 months. Mm-hmm. Then we could kind of say, do you know what? We maybe don't need the CRM with all the data, but we can use an Excel spreadsheet for the database. Mm-hmm. We can still do the photo shoot. We'll still have a content management system. We won't go out to tender. There's one we used before. We use in-house. We'll still get a content writer. If we've got a week, right, then we might hard code the website, for example, right? Because we've only got a week. Alex might write the copy himself. Maybe get some mates to take the photos who he knows is a professional photographer. If you need to find a job tomorrow, all right, we might just use LinkedIn, update your LinkedIn profile, okay? Maybe take a photo yourself and upload it. Now, all those four kind of solutions all have the same objective and arguably might have a similar outcome in terms of, you know, our objective was to promote Alex's knowledge, experience, and brilliance, all right? And all those things do it. But what we need to be able to do is change the fidelity of the solution to adapt to the timeline, not assume that the solution has to be some massive thing. And then the only option to go from the year down to 3 months is to reduce quality, get everyone to work over the weekend, whatever it might be, cram everything together. And that's when we get into trouble, when we don't give ourselves this kind of ability to flex and adapt the solution to meet the timelines.
Firstly, I'd just like to intervene here. So you could write, you know, everything you need to know about me and on the back of a postage stamp. So we're all good, right? and actually the solution to the problem that you provide there is just start a podcast, mate. Everything flows from there.
There you go.
I've got two of them and I'm clearly very, very successful. So there you go. You know, don't even need to ask AI. That's my advice to you.
That kind of makes sense, the point, right? I think that's the thing we miss. We assume, again, it comes back to that point. We assume we know what the solution is. We assume it has to be quite big. And then, you know, people talk about the iron triangle. We have to break one of those things. So we have to break the scope, or we have to break the quality, or we have to push out the time limits. No, let's try and solutionize within the time limits. What could we do within that time frame?
right? And then also, you know, let's allow ourselves a level of experimentation. Let's get a, you know, if it's 3 months, let's get a working version into the hands of people within a month to see if we're along the wrong lines or the right lines. Let's use that thing that's never talked about, which is at the heart of Scrum, or at least should be, empiricism. Let's make decisions based on what can be observed, what can be used, what we can interact with.
Yeah, absolutely. And they are the real elements, like you say, of agile, that you know, as you move away, you know, from, oh, well, we're not implementing Scrum, we're implementing agile. But, well, what do you mean by that? It's like, well, look, I mean, I've always maintained this, you know, it's a way of thinking. It's a way of seeing the world. And I agree, you know, if you've got deadlines, there's nothing better than having, you know, agile, which says, well, we're going to knock something out every 2 weeks or every month. We're just not telling you now what that thing's going to be. And we're not making these crazy promises that, you know, it's going to be this, you know, step one, step two, step three. And then, you know, after 3 months, you'll have exactly that. Because during month one, we've already come across a load of issues that we should work out. And we should work them out together and come up with the most sensible solution at the time that still moves us forward if we can. And I've always felt that's the really tricky bit, which people don't necessarily kind of get in their head.
And I think the other point is kind of that's rarely talked about is kind of preserving optionality, right? So making sure that we can change our mind and do something different. And just the another kind of moving the conversation on a little bit, another real bugbear of mine is this kind of conflation of agile and Scrum, right? And we kind of use them in the same breath as if they're exactly the same thing. There's so many other great kind of practices which are associated with agile, and I think that the problem with Scrum is it's you know, even if we do conflate Scrum with agile with Scrum, Scrum's chronically misunderstood, right? Which I find really frustrating, because the Scrum guide is what, 14 pages long or something. You could read it in your lunch break, and we fixate on the kind of what for some reason are called the ceremonies, but I don't think they've ever been referred to that as a Scrum guide in the Scrum guide. But the events, rather than understanding the kind of the theory that sits behind it, and also, you know, agile's not right for everything. If you're working in a really clear domain, then where there's absolute cause and effect, then, you know, maybe waterfall's the answer for you. And I think that we need to use kind of contextually appropriate mindsets, mental models, methodologies for the area in which we're working. It's not this cookie cutter thing of one size fits all. You know, if you're in the kind of genesis of things, to use Simon Wardley's phrase from Wardley mapping, then we need rapid experimentation. You know, there's loads of change. We need to lean into that change. Whereas if we're working in a very commoditized area, then, you know, Scrum is absolutely the wrong thing to do. We should be, you know, using something like Six Sigma or ITIL or something, things that I don't really understand. But this idea that there's just a one size fits all, I think is incorrect. I've worked for years with a friend of mine, Alan Kelly, an agile coach. And I hope you'll forgive me if I get this wrong. I'm paraphrasing him, but he says that the way to know that the only way to know that you're agile is if your teams are working in a different way to the way they were working 3 months ago. But this idea, there's one way of doing things and it shall never change, is just kind of anathema to agility itself.
Yeah. And so if we sort of zoom out a bit and look at the thing we're really saying here, which is that ultimately, you know, you've got goals, you've got outcomes, the thing that you want to do, the reason for you doing any of this. And you know, I mean, you can always zoom out and say make more money. But obviously, you know, you're usually talking about something a little bit more focused there than that. In a particular domain, in a company, in a particular area, what are we going to do that contributes to that goal? And we have to, you know, that is, I'm in marketing. So how do we improve the marketing? I mean, you know, I mean, on the e-commerce side of things, you know, what channels do we have, and how do we improve those, or can we add new channels and so on? And so you've got an endpoint that you can sort of describe and articulate how quickly people get into talking about the sausages of the sausage machine, right? When actually, when you put pork in, you can get all sorts of other things like meatballs and all sorts, right? And really, the issue becomes when people get so fixated on an endpoint, and then you put in an agile solution in the middle there, which is designed to tune as you go along, right? And to say, well, this thing worked, but this thing didn't. Priorities changed, so we're now doing this thing over that thing, right? And it allows you to iterate and report back to the business in very tight cycles. And the reason for that is not because necessarily that the business, you know, are very prissy and they need constant attention. It's so that you can constantly course check. Right. And you can constantly look at priorities, but also what you're making. Right. How often do you get in the middle of a development cycle for an app, which the endpoint on, you know, like a phone app, which the endpoint seemed obvious, that you get to a point and go, well, actually, no, now I see this working. It's not working. Right. It's not going to do what we thought it was. It's not going to elicit the behavior that we thought it was going to elicit. And therefore we need to course correct right now, right? And this does speak to your, you know, obviously there are certain outcomes which pretty much are set in stone. If what you've got to do is build out a system to handle some sort of regulatory or tax constraint, you might need to be very specific about what you get at the other end, because it there's an outside influence that says, no, it just has to be this way, right? At which point perhaps you are doing waterfall, right? But in most of the cases, I think we're talking about it's if you're ignoring that ability to course correct and you just see something like Agile as a set of sort of communication points along what's ultimately a waterfall process, then you're missing the power of Agile, and you're also missing the opportunities to do things like injecting stuff like the power of being able to prototype things with AI, right? So if you're too fixated on that endpoint, say, no, we're just building an app and it's supposed to look like this, then you probably are using the wrong process, right? And you're probably throwing away the real power and the real benefit of that process.
Yeah, I'm kind of agreeing with you, but the other way around. If your aim is to deliver a prescribed thing, then you've probably got the right process. But I often say to teams that if you define the solution up front, then the very best scenario we can be in a year's time is that you get what you wanted a year ago, not what you need right now. I think that we just need to be really mindful of what's the correct process to use. If I can just come back to like where this conversation came from as well, Alex, which is this notion of collapsing the process or collapsing the software delivery development lifecycle. I was working with a team last year, right, who were at their kind of wit's end, big team, and I asked them to show me their process. And they showed me it, and it was what you'd, you know, expect. It's very clean. It had, you know, the classic Scrum kind of arrow thing going on. But I went and spoke to lots of people involved in this process and mapped out the actual process. And it was this kind of labyrinth of pathways with kind of dead ends and multiple kind of loops within loops and all this kind of stuff. And I kind of said to them, look, imagine just delivering like hello world, right, through this process would probably take weeks if you had nothing else to do, right? Because there's so many steps to it. But then if you add in all the other work that is in this massive pipeline process, then it's no wonder that you're getting frustrated with it, because it's going to take weeks and months for any one thing to get through it. I suggested that they experiment with their process, right? And that what we did, I kind of said, let's do two things. Let's focus on collaboration and focus. Let's focus on focus, right? So we decided to collapse the process almost entirely. And what did that mean? That actually meant two people got to speak to each other. Two or three people spoke to each other. Somebody from the business, and there was a technologist. And then I said, okay, our other kind of principle of this experiment is
focus, right? So what's the most important thing that we could be working on right now? And they said, it's this thing. So I said, okay, we'll crack on, like have a chat, define the problem first. And they spent some time defining the problem and they documented it, but the documentation was an output of that discussion. I think it was on a Miro board or something. And then they worked together to solve it. And they had a number of runs at this and it took a couple of weeks, I think. And then they deployed it, right? And it radically changed the operations of their business, right? I didn't know this at the time, but it was an annual change that they had to make. And they'd failed to do it the previous 2 years and they managed to achieve it this time. And it completely radically changed everything. Now, if they'd stuck with that old process, that thing would have taken months for them even to be able to take a look at it, in which case we'd, you know, be working towards 2027 rather than 2026. And I just found that kind of fascinating, that actually just stopping, thinking, what are we doing here? And then experimenting with simplifying the process. And, you know, what's the first agile value is individuals and interactions over processes and tools, getting individuals to interact with one another rather than focusing on a process like Scrum and a tool like Jira. And yeah, I'm not saying we didn't use tools. We didn't have a process. It was a very basic process. But the heart of the matter, the focus of the experiment was getting individuals to interact with one another. Now, to your point, yes, we can bring AI or an agent into that, which maybe speeds up that process even more. I said it took a couple of weeks to focus on one thing. Maybe we could use AI to more rapidly prototype, more rapidly learn. But that's fantastic, right? You know, I think that the thing about AI is it's an amplifier, right? If they had added AI to that massive, complicated process, I think it would have made things worse. It would have made those invisible cues even longer. But if they add it to a good, simple process, then yeah, it might make things better. So if you've got a rubbish process, I think AI might make it even worse. If you've got a good one, it'll make it even better.
Yeah, I can really see that. You know, I can really see, oh, well, look, we've got this big, long process. Let's get the AI to help us improve it. And really what you're saying is, you can do that, but you're just going to get probably more of what you don't want quicker. Whereas actually, let's experiment with how we're doing it. And then in that experimentation, all right, how can I use AI to help me out with that? And I think that's some of the things, you know, which could be useful is if that AI can help you knock out a prototype in, you know, like 2 hours rather than 2 days, that's going to be very useful. But if you're asking the AI, how can I route my tickets more efficiently, then
it comes back to this mental model, doesn't it? Your mental model is that we need to deliver a ton of stuff more quickly than we currently do, then what you're going to do is focus on velocity, speed. You're probably going to point it at do what we were talking about earlier on in terms of local optimizations. But if you acknowledge, perhaps this isn't the case, but you're in a the solution you're going to deliver will exist in a complex environment where you need an emergent solution, then you need to you don't need to, but it would be sensible to, if you're going to use AI, to help it allow you to learn more rapidly what is and what isn't a good solution. And once it is live and out there, to look to optimize it and flex it based on what you are learning and the kind of environment, the changes in the environment in which it exists.
Mm-hmm. I love this idea that, it's just perfectly put that AI is an amplifier. I'm gonna steal that, Toby, and use it everywhere now. It really, really illuminates quite a few. People like us, we're in the weeds, right? And sometimes you need a sort of lever to get you out of those weeds. And you're sort of, I'm just thinking, Pete, this week, last week of trying to pull a slide deck together with AI, and just especially after the last episode, sort of slightly failing and ending up doing it myself by hand. What's interesting about that is that now you put it in that context, I'm looking at this going, well, All that the AI did was amplify my chaos because I didn't know what I was doing. And I knew what the outcome needed to be. I just didn't know what we needed to do to get there. And the same with things like writing like podcast episodes and, you know, things like blog posts and stuff, anything that I author, I kind of, the process is writing it, right? How do I know what this is going to be? Will I write it? Right, I know roughly what endpoint I want to get to, but often I've got halfway through it and gone, well, actually, the endpoint I thought isn't particularly strong. But now I'm thinking about this, I've written this, I've written that, I'm starting to see something else come together here that's much more powerful, right? And letting AI do that, it always goes through multiple iterations of telling me the wrong thing, which is sometimes actually quite useful. Right. Mm-hmm. So write me an article on, you know, the cheese making process and I want to make it funny and interesting. Well, it's like it's going to make a terrible job of that, but at least I'll see what bad looks like. And this really does sort of ratchet back out to my ultimate view of these things in that we get very much caught. Like businesses are chaos. Anti-chaos machines, right? The only reason a business exists is to minimize the amount of chaos and disorder within a system to achieve a certain end, right? I'm not suggesting that they do that, they achieve that, but strictly speaking, everything that happens in the business is about taking out fat and enforcing uniformity, homogeneity, and efficiency in an effort to make sure that the end point, that the thing that you're making, you're creating, is of a uniform quality, right? Be that consultancy hours or burgers, right? And so you can see why this, you get caught in these very complex and elaborate and labyrinthine structures the business is designed to minimize the amount of chaos in that system, but then those become really constrained. And this is not new news, right? The issue is in any business is either because or even despite those processes, things take time, right? And so you have to take a punt on a solution for something, and then sort of test that, and it takes some time to get to some way of testing it, right? Which will take effort and process and so on. And this is not a thing. That's not a negotiable, right? What changes is that process gets easier. So it gets easier to test things until you get to some point where in magic wand territory, whereby you can do anything, right? And you can just hit a button or wave your magic wand and you have an output, right? So I really need an app that does this thing on phones for my business, right? I'm going to hit the button. There it is. The app's right there now. And you can either try it out or you will immediately see that, no, this is not right. You know, this is wrong. We need to try a different thing. There's no risk there. There's no time. There's nothing. You've just got it. And it's either right or it's not. What AI brings to this process is, I'm not going to pretend that it solves it. It is like that, but it gets us way closer than anything we've ever had before. And it sort of breaks down that risk. And I think, you know, as you've put really well, Toby, if you apply it to the old process ways of thinking, and perhaps those processes still need to exist, you run the risk of amplifying the thing that that process does, which is to try and constrain things, right? Whereas if you break things down into smaller chunks and if you see things and don't obsess about endpoints, just obsess about the journey and the goals, then AI should really should amplify the right parts of that and should speed things up. You can certainly fail faster with AI.
Yeah, and again, sometimes you want to fail faster when you're creating a new thing. But if something is, you know, has been commoditized and you have a genuine production line, which is just churning out Yaris's or marbles or sausages or whatever it might be, you know, you don't really want to fail, do you? You want to standardize. You want to
make sure things are ordered and measured and exactly the same as they always were. So again, it's about having this kind of contextually appropriate mindset, mental model, methodologies, whatever it might be. So again, there's no kind of cookie cutter for this, but as an amplifier, AI can help in all those different kind of approaches. Just need to make sure you've got one that's appropriate for what you are trying to achieve. And just again, moving the conversation on slightly, the thing about constraints, I think, is really important. Working within constraints is a kind of fantastic thing to do. This idea about ensuring that things are all consistent, I think that's one thing that's often missed, the kind of working within the, I use the phrase guardrails. Guardrails seems to have got a bad reputation recently because it's seen as some kind of sweeping thing that just means that AI can never be dangerous. But when I'm talking about kind of software engineering, the guardrails are at kind of agreed standards you work within, whether they're from the kind of user experience, it's like the principles we work within. What kind of experience are we trying to enable here? Or if it's from a creative perspective, it's like the brand guidelines or the whatever it might be, the color scheme or whatever. And technically, it might be like the coding standards or whatever it is. But having those constraints is super important because that allows the teams to focus on what they can change, the decisions they can make. All right, so it's kind of agreeing what we're not going to touch or what we're going to work within. And then the other constraint, sorry, I'm going back to Scrum again now, is the time constraint. All right, the idea of a sprint isn't what a lot of teams use it for, which is a period of time to cram as much work into as possible. It's actually meant to be a way to limit our thinking. That example I gave earlier of the promoting Alex's website or whatever it might be. Like if we had 6 months, we'd do this. If we only have 2 weeks, what do we not do in order to achieve this within a much shorter time period? So it's meant to actually make it difficult for us to make tough decisions about what we're not going to do, how we're going to reduce that fidelity, allowing us to deliver something of value, empirically of value, more quickly and to learn more rapidly as well.
And for me, I think this is really interesting because that way of thinking and approaching tasks really feels like is where we should be, you know, and as you say, things like agile, you know, are about being flexible, about experimentation. But it still seems that after sort of the advent of the computer and bringing it into business, that we all still seem to think as humans fairly, not in that way. We're not looking for, in general, ways to experiment. We're looking for ways to assign tasks to people. Do you know what I mean? And the hierarchy of a company is, well, you know, I've got this person managing them, so therefore he must be getting them to do things. Therefore, please give me a report of what your people are doing. Do you know what I mean? It's very much based around, again, getting to back to some sort of manufacturing. All right, well, you work in that team, that must mean you put the rivets in here. Yeah, okay, so how many rivets are you doing? You know, that's a conversation that as a sort of senior manager I can have. Whereas conversations around, oh, well, we're experimenting at the moment, we're looking how we can push this forward, and we're trying to understand what the changes we require, just sounds way too woolly for everybody. And writing that down, it's much, much harder. I think it's what we should be doing. I just think it's, you know, it's harder on the communication. It's harder for people to therefore say they've made progress when, well, we're just experimenting here.
Yeah, P, there's a really, if you haven't seen it already, there's a really amazing talk given by Mary Popendiek quite a while ago now, mm-hmm. where I think it's called The Tyranny of the Plan, right? And she makes the point that we only started planning things down to the task level when computers were invented, and we actually could do that, right? Mm-hmm. So when, again, coming back to this mental model of a solution that we know will, you know, assumed success, which is a really dangerous thing in a complex environment, then what we do is we indulge in reductionism, right? Where mm-hmm. we take the big thing, we break it down into small things, mm-hmm. we use something like Scrum and go, hey, look how agile we are. We're doing this in small chunks. And then we have to build the individual little tasks back up into a big thing and then do some kind of big bang release. So it almost becomes, because we can do it, we do it. And then because we as leaders don't necessarily understand what these crazy technologists are doing, we start to measure the things that we can measure, right? Which are the tasks, task completion. We are, you know, 17% of the way through our tasks, which is the opposite of empiricism, which is the opposite about, you know, making decisions based on what can be observed.
Mm. Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, it's funny, you know, I mean, Jira is a similar thing to that, right? You know, a great tool to sort of measure things. All right, now we can measure absolutely everything. All right, well, now let's just bung everything in there.
back to the sort of, we can't get away from these bloody production line analogies, can we? But like, you know, that everyone's got their job, and perhaps actually construction's a slightly better example here. You know, you start talking about rivets and what's your job to put the bricks there, your job to do the carpentry and so on. And actually, what way prior to the AI insertion into everything, we had the migration in many circumstances to DevOps style delivery and continuous integration and things like that. And that for me feels a little bit like collapsing the sort of the skills and the roles environment, whereby, you know, you're the bricklayer, you're the carpenter, you're the person does the rivets and so on, to, you know, we've all got our aptitudes and specific skills, but actually you could end up doing anything, right? Our job is to build the house, not just be the builder, right? The person, the bricklayer. And so there's a level to which the software development community has responded to that, and the enabling technologies that surround that, and that perhaps the process, and so they're probably pretty well set up to behave in the way that we're alluding towards here. It's just that the process hasn't caught up, and then when you throw AI into the mix, you've turbocharged those developers, but they're still within an environment that still wants things done in a certain way, which is A, gonna, you know, come unstuck, and B, not really using the new, you know, DevOps plus AI, the new environment to the best of its capabilities.
Yeah, the DevOps thing's really interesting, right? Because, you know, one of the principles of DevOps is shared ownership. And to my mind, that means collapsing the process to have a tight collaboration. And ideally, I suppose if we go back to XP, that's about having the user within the team, right? So you have a super short, tight feedback loop or customer in the team. But you kind of alluded it to there, Alex. This is pretty difficult for these, particularly for big established organizations, because their hierarchy is based upon disciplines. And so having this tight collaboration goes almost literally against the grain of the organization, which is based around, I am within this team that have this discipline, or this team that have this discipline. So the natural inclination is to hand things from one team to one discipline to another, because we are incentivized to do the work within our team, our discipline. So, you know, I'm incentivized to create great wireframes, or I'm incentivized to write code that somebody else can test, or I'm incentivized to whatever it might be. It's interesting how even the process or principles around DevOps still gets kind of broken out into, you know, the notion of like a DevOps engineer. Well, we've brought in this concept of DevOps, but we've separated out an individual to do a specific thing. And yeah, you might need that. You might need somebody to set up the CI/CD pipelines or something. But I sometimes think like a DevOps individual is like having, you know, the collaboration person. Where are they? Oh, she sits over there in the corner. Like, it's just, again, we're trying to kind of separate and ensure that these things do fit into this production line metaphor.
Yeah, it's nuts, isn't it?
Yeah. And that specialization, I mean, this is really interesting because it really got me thinking there. As you say, you know, you then form teams around the specialization. And one of the things that AI can do for you is if you're a specialist in discipline A and you want a bit of B done, is you can now ask the AI and it will do B for you. And it can be a little bit random, but in general, it's usually pretty good. And so what that means is that team A now doesn't have to hand off to team B because they've got a good enough piece of work. They've got the AI to do, and then they can just continue working. And I think that's one of the things which people are seeing and thinking, oh, well, that's interesting. And Alex and I have had many discussions about that's both good and bad. It's good if the machine actually does a good job for you. It's not so good if it doesn't, because you're not a specialist in it, you might not recognize it's done a bad job. But if you can get that balance, then actually that's exactly what it addresses, as you say, Toby, is, you know, an organization is set up with three teams. What we're saying actually is the guy in team A can do all three things well enough to keep going and actually build out what they need.
These collaborative teams, what you're really looking for, I'm just thinking about this, you're looking for these, you know, the classic things, the T-shaped person who has like a depth of knowledge, but has also a shallower, broad knowledge. I suppose AI can make people more T-shaped. And that's not to say, I think that's often misunderstood as everyone can do everything. No, you can't, but you could, as a user experience person, you could sit alongside the developer and help her or him, you know, make better decisions. You're not mm-hmm. necessarily the person doing the code, and arguably AI can get that person to do the code, but I suppose it might help make people more T-shape, which does then enable flow and enable more rapid learning and more and better rapid delivery, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And I quite like that, you know, if you bring constraints into that, it's quite nice as well, because you say, well, look, we're not saying that you should do everything, but it might enable you to get something done, but let's keep a constraint that still needs to be passed by, you know, the design guy. So great, we can knock up some quick designs and move forward, but we're not deploying that until the design guys have definitely given it some form of sign off. So you could introduce that as, you know, a secondary sort of constraint to work with, so that you're not, you know, trying to force everyone to be, you know, brilliant at everything.
It's interesting that the kind of notion of design. So when I've worked with really good teams, we really focus on the valuable working software, right? Now, if we do need some kind of sketch, great, but I would much rather the person who is the expert at creative design sits with a developer, and the design essentially is the software, or the software is the design, right? Mm-hmm. But again, working within those constraints, you've got to make sure it fits within the design guidelines, the branding guidelines, whatever it might be. But again, the moment we start having a design phase, we're immediately back into this kind of production line, and we end up with, you know, the classic thing is when the creative designs are like 5 months ahead of the software delivery, because it's quicker to create designs than it is to write software. But maybe that's changing, I don't know. But it's so easy to fall into the trap of, we have a phase, then another phase, then another phase. You know, if Agile's anything, it's about delivering valuable working software iteratively, which should be our aim, which delights the user. It's only valuable if it meets an aim, and, you know, people love it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so I want to try and bring this to a close. My head actually hurts. This has been such a broad ranging conversation, and we've touched on the minutiae of software development, and actually to a critique of the whole concept of business organization and process, which is mad when you think about it, because this it runs to from the top of the bottom of an organization. Every organization exists to deliver things in almost every case that is done via technology, and that was the case back in the days when, you know, the Industrial Revolution, when technology was whatever, factories or looms or whatever, and to now where it's all done, you know, in the cloud on computers. As a consultant, Toby, how do you tackle that? I guess what I mean by that is that we've often struggled, me and Pete, with trying to make changes in organisations when what you're dealing with is a sort of a project level, right? That there's always another level of process and hierarchy outside what, you know, the project that you're working on, that's trying to impose its need to do things in a certain way on you. So how do you deal with the sort of transforming process and delivery within a wider organization that probably isn't ready to behave like that?
Yes, it's not especially easy, but I think they avoid the temptation to tell people they're wrong and they're doing it wrong and that you know what's right. A kind of tactic I often use is to visualize stuff is really important. So I've worked with a team fairly recently where I just asked them to visualize their process, and eventually somebody put their hand up and grabbed the permanent marker or the Sharpie and started drawing the process. And the thing that wasn't so interesting was the process itself, which was incredibly complicated, but was the reaction, where after about 20 minutes, he put his head in his hand and said, "I've never stopped to think how complicated this is." So visualizing stuff is really good. The other thing is agreeing kind of principles, like agreeing what we want to achieve and make sure people understand what kind of success might look like or will look like. And then agreeing kind of principles, that thing I said earlier about, you know, the principle around kind of focus and collaboration, whatever those are, but you don't impose those. You get teams to kind of agree what those are. And then I'd do what you should be doing with your product if it's in those kind of early stages. It's experiment. So let's run an experiment where we where we really double down on those principles. Let's do things quite radically differently. And you know what? It might not work, right? This might not be right. Like, I've seen this work elsewhere, but it might not be right for your organizational structure, your internal politics, your culture, whatever it might be. But let's try something different. And that example I gave towards the end of last year, what I only realized afterwards is that by doing that, you give teams the kind of psychological safety to try something different. This is Amy Edmondson's concept, right? So teams themselves are very rarely going to say, "Hey, you know what? This isn't working. Let's rip this up and start again," right? But as a consultant, you come in and you can take some of the blame if it does go wrong. You give people the ability to try to do something differently. I think people usually recognize that what they're doing, if they have this really elaborate process where almost nothing is coming out of it or the things that come out aren't especially valuable, they want to try something radically different. But having the ability to say, "We're going to change things," is actually really difficult. So experiment, acknowledge what's worked and crucially what hasn't worked, and then make other teams aware of it and look to kind of expand that out. That doesn't mean it will work for the other teams as well. Again, they will have their own challenges and culture and different incentives and so forth. But just having the ability to show people a different way of doing things, and it may be elements of it can work within their organization, is good.
I really see. I mean, I think that's amazing, and there's an element of really the overarching view there is sort of leading the horse to water thing, where effectively you can't tell people what's wrong with their business and how to do it better and stuff. They're the best at it because they're doing their job, and actually what you really just need to do is help them see for themselves where these deficits are, and from there things flow much more smoothly, because the moment people recognize the flavor and the size and the shape of that sort of that type of problem, which is often very, very opaque and so tightly bound within the way that people do things and business cultures and so on, that it's almost impossible to see. So if you can draw people's attention to it, the moment they see it, they can't unsee it. The moment they see the structural problems, they're like, oh, okay, no, I can't unsee that. And they will change it because it will become completely unbearable for them to live with it.
Yeah. Again, a slightly separate point, but it's a word you've used a few times, Alex, is getting people to acknowledge where the risks lie, right? Where is the risks? Because what we should be trying to do, actually think Agile should be great at this, is de-risking initiatives, right? So if you are kind of inventing a new thing, or not even inventing, but delivering a thing that maybe hasn't been delivered before, the risk is that nobody wants it. Right. The risk isn't that we don't deliver this big thing at all. I mean, that's a risk if you know exactly what you need to deliver, which is rarely the case. But I think the risk in these early stages is, like Eric Ries talks about, product market fit, right? That there is no market for this thing. So let's learn as rapidly as possible. Whereas if you're in this kind of commoditized space, the risk is that things are inconsistent, right? Or that there are fluctuations, right? We want these things to be super consistent. So I think being really aware of where the risk is and how you would mitigate against that is something we quite often don't step back from. We have these risk logs, which are all focused around delivery. Will we deliver it? Can we deliver it? Not should we deliver it, or should we deliver something else? So I think, focusing on not just the risk of delivery, but the risk we are kind of trying to address, I suppose. It might be the risk that a competitor gets there first, you know, being aware and bringing that to the forefront of people's mind. What is the risk? Why are we doing this thing?
I'm in violent agreement. Pete, any closing thoughts from you?
I thought it was really, really interesting. As always, test and learn is the way to go, is definitely... The mindset that we have, one reason we work in the space we work in, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Agile from the ground upwards. Toby, anything else from you?
No, just thanks for the time. I appreciate the conversation. It's been really good. And good to see you again, Alex, and good to meet you.
Yeah, great.
Fusion Matrix.
Yeah, it's been amazing. We should do this again sometime. Right. Brilliant. Well, we'll close this one here, and I'll see everyone again soon.